best we can, and I'll need your help in this. This is a big subject. The book of Revelation is the last book in the Bible, and probably it's the last book of the Bible that the Christian mind begins to understand. It's the cap sheaf on the Bible, and perhaps ideally should be studied after everything else in the Bible. But there aren't too many things in life that we approach in an ideal way. And we welcome each one of you with us here today, no matter what your background is, and whether you've studied the rest of the Bible or not. We're happy to have young and old with us in our study of the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation is a book of prophecy. Before prophets were called prophets, they were called seers, according to 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 9. A seer is one who sees things that others cannot, one to whom God gave a special enlightenment. A prophet is one who speaks under divine impulse. While the prophets were speaking or writing under inspiration, they didn't always know what they were talking about. The Apostle Peter tells us that they were fairly frequently searching what or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ which was in them did signify when he testified aforehand the suffering of Christ and the glory that should follow. What this means is that you and I in our time can probably understand the book of Isaiah better than Isaiah himself understood it when he wrote it. You and I can understand the book of Revelation better than the Apostle John did when he wrote it. He wrote it down accurately, but I don't suspect at all that he understood everything that he was writing about. We need to have some confidence in the ability that God has given us to understand the information that he has provided for us by information. Now, I don't know how you feel as you approach the book of Revelation. I know a lot of people approach it with a sense of trepidation. That's just too deep for me. I hope that not a single one of you will feel that way as we approach this book. I believe that we can each have a good general understanding of the book if we want it and if we want to work for it. Some of you may be studying the book of Revelation for the very first time, and we welcome that. Others of you have been through it many times. Some of you have taught it on numerous occasions. So we have a wide variety of scope in the students in this class. And if you are studying it for the first time, be aware that anything you approach for the first time may cause a sense of apprehension. That's normal. Remember the first time that you ever drove a car and how you felt as you got out onto the road or as you pulled on the entrance ramp onto a freeway for the first time. The sense of tension and stress that may have been involved in that. Now you hop in a car, you just drive around. The worst problem is keeping your mind on what you're doing. I had an aunt one time who had a wreck the first time she drove a car, and she never did learn to drive. The more familiar you make yourself with anything, the more you persevere in it, the easier it becomes. I don't blame you, any of you, for feeling a little unsure about some things in the book of Revelation. I'm unsure about some of the things in it too. But I hope you won't let that stop you from digging into this to the extent of the ability that God has personally placed within you. And I hope you won't let it stop you from asking questions. There isn't any such thing as a stupid question as long as it's sincere and coming from an earnest heart. The Greeks used to say we feed on questions. And that's really the way I feel about it as we approach the book of Revelation. We need this. We need the time together to bat these ideas back and forth. Lord willing, we're going to study this. It's not to be a lecture. And I would like to go at your pace. If you think I'm going too fast, just slow me down. If I'm not going fast enough, speed me up. If you don't understand something, ask for a further explanation. If you don't agree with something, say so. And just if you say it doesn't make sense, we'll try to explore it. And maybe it doesn't make sense. We'll try to look for a better explanation. If you get lost, please say so. And that's a very important thing because there are building blocks involved here in the study of the book of Revelation. If you were teaching a child mathematics, you would understand that there are certain things they need to learn before they can build anything on top of that foundation. And that's the way it is with this book, I think. Later material builds on earlier material. We need the basics in order to continue. So in order to stay together as a class, it's important for each of us to be as involved as we can in the lesson and try to understand as we go along. And if we don't understand something, ask your question about it right then. Please ask your questions as they occur to you. Don't wait for me to call on you. I may not see your hand. Just please speak up and let's make it a class. Now, it's already been pointed out by Clayton that the book of Revelation was written by the Apostle John, the last surviving apostle. I believe it was written about 96 A.D. Irenaeus in the 2nd century said, quote, "The apostolic vision was seen not very long since, but almost in our day," he said, toward the end of Domitian's reign. And that's good enough for me. I think Irenaeus was in a good position to know when the book of Revelation was written. He said that the Apostle John wrote it near the end of the reign of Domitian. Domitian died in 96 AD. The letter dictated by the Lord to the Ephesian church in Revelation chapter 2, beginning in verse 1, corroborates the time period that was indicated by Irenaeus. Actually, we have four letters in the New Testament that were sent to the city of Ephesus. Can you tell me what they were? What are the four letters in the New Testament that were sent to the city of Ephesus? I'll give you a hint. Number one is the Ephesian letter.
It was 3rd John.
Not that I know of. It could have been, but I'm not in a position to say that it was.
Colossians?
Well, the Colossian letter was probably sent to Colossae, which wasn't all that far away. But what I'm thinking of here is 1st and 2nd Timothy. Timothy was working in Ephesus at the time. Paul says, "As I besought thee to abide still at Ephesus when I went into Macedonia, that thou mightest charge some that they teach no other doctrine." So the Ephesian letter was sent to the city of Ephesus. 1st and 2nd Timothy were two letters sent to the city of Ephesus. And then in Revelation 2, we have this other Ephesian letter dictated by the Lord. But my point in bringing this up is that you can tell that the Ephesian letter and 1st and 2nd Timothy were written in the same general time period, in the same generation. They're dealing with some of the same issues. And this book, this letter that the Lord dictates, starting in Revelation 2, verse 1, is written after the trouble that Timothy went to help out with. It's written a generation later. It's looking back at those troubles and talking about them. "You have tried those who said they were apostles and found them to be liars," and these sorts of things. It wasn't written at the same time at all, which makes sense if the book of Revelation was written in 90 AD. If it was written in 70, in the era of the 70 AD or so, or before 70 AD even, as some would say, then it doesn't fit very well at all. And so this is one reason I take the position that it was written at near the end of the first century. Domitian was the second great persecutor of the church among the Roman emperors. Nero was the first. Nero's persecution was confined mainly to the city of Rome itself and the Roman environs. Nero used to take Christians and dip them in wax and use them to light up as torches his garden parties at night. The disciple whom Jesus loved, the Apostle John, apparently was taken by Domitian and boiled in oil. And we're told, according to tradition, that his skin became one giant blister and all came off, but yet he did not die. God providentially or even miraculously kept him alive. And so when Domitian couldn't kill him, the story goes that that's why he exiled him to the Isle of Patmos. The Bible teaches us that John was on the Isle of Patmos, and history tells us that it was Domitian who put him there and the reason that he was put there. The Isle of Patmos was a rocky promontory out in the Aegean Sea with thousands of other islands there, and this is the place where John received the material that became the book of Revelation. Now, until 150 years ago, nobody doubted that it was the Apostle John who wrote the book of Revelation, and unless there's somebody here today who doubts it, then I don't know that there's any reason to look at any other ideas. There's a statement made that Clayton read a while ago in chapter 1, verse 3, that this was to give us information about things that must shortly come to pass. Things that must shortly come to pass. I'm sorry, that's in verse 1 of chapter 1. We're going to be looking at the book of Revelation from a historical point of view. I believe that it began to be fulfilled right away at 96 AD as soon as the Apostle John received this information and wrote it down and sent it to the churches. Right after that, it began to be fulfilled.
Is there a blackboard here?
Yeah,
whiteboard. Even better.
Going to be doing this, Lord willing, from a continuous continuous historical point of view. To me, this is the one that makes the most sense, all things considered. Some people call this the historicist view. You'll find it referred to in a number of ways. This is actually the oldest method that was used for understanding the book of Revelation. The longer I live, the more convinced I am that it is the correct view of the book. To me, it's far more satisfying than any other view I have ever encountered. It means that prophecies had historical fulfillments, and that's always been true. God's prophecies, even way back in the book of Genesis, had historical fulfillments. That very first messianic prophecy, the proto-evangelium in Genesis 3:15, was fulfilled historically in the coming of the Messiah. Thou shalt bruise, he shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. The seed of the woman was being spoken about there. When Joseph had a dream that came from God, it had a historical fulfillment that was understandable. Pharaoh's dreams were the same way, the butler and the baker's dreams. And we haven't even gotten out of the book of Genesis yet, but that was true all the way through the Old Testament. Old Testament prophecies had historical fulfillments, and New Testament prophecies have historical fulfillments as well. In chapter 1, verse 19, which Clayton also read, the Apostle John is told to write the things which you have seen. Now, those would be the things that he's already talked about, I think, there in chapter 1, the things that you have seen. And write the things which are. The Lord was about to tell in chapters 2 and 3 how things are in the seven churches. The way that God looked at them was not the way that man looked at them at all. It's possible for somebody to have a name that they live but really be dead. And the Lord with his x-ray vision could see all of that. So write the things that you have seen. That's chapter 1, basically. Write the things which are. That's chapter 2 and 3. Write the things which shall be hereafter. That's pretty much most of the rest of the book from the perspective of 96 AD where the Apostle John was writing this. I will show you things which must be hereafter, he was told in chapter 4, verse 1. Come up here, and I will show you things which must be hereafter. And in chapter 5, he sees a scroll that has writing just not one on one side, but on both sides of it, and it's sealed with seven seals. In chapter 6, verse 1, the Lamb opens the first seal on that scroll, and the history begins to unroll in a panoramic picture of what in John's time was the future. In our time, most of it is history. I think at some point, this picture becomes pretty rough on the apostate church. And that may be the reason why a couple of Jesuits originated a couple of other views of the book of Revelation that bear mentioning. There is the preterist view, and I'm saying the, although there are a number of preterist views that would differ in their details. A preterist view in general, though, believes that the book of Revelation began to be fulfilled about the time it was written, and the fulfillment was pretty much concluded during the times of the pagan Roman Empire. Some would end this about, well, some would even end it with 70 AD. That would be a kind of an extreme preterist position. Some would end it about 325 with the Council of Nicaea. Some would end it about 476 with the fall of the Western Roman Empire. But it basically has to do with the pagan Roman Empire as we think of that, as we ordinarily think of that. And then it would stop there. Although many preterists do believe that there is a section of the book of Revelation about the judgment that is still to come, although some of them do not. Anyway, if I wasn't going to take the position that I take, I probably would take a preterist position. Lots and lots of Church of Christ preachers, many of whom I've known, take that position in our time. The continuous historical view is not as popular or prominent among some of them as it used to be. And they make a big emphasis on the fact that these are things that must shortly come to pass. My rejoinder to that, I guess, would be, what makes you think 300 years is short? Doesn't it make sense to think that he's saying that these things must shortly begin to come to pass? They're not all going to happen at once, but they would shortly begin to come to pass. Anyway, another Jesuit took just the opposite approach to this and originated what is known in our world as a futurist view. And I hope I'm spelling that. When I get back there, I'll see all the words I misspelled, but when I'm close, I don't always see it. I think that's the way you spell futurist. The general thrust behind this philosophy is that at least chapter 6 through the end, maybe even chapter 4 through the end, are still in the future yet to be fulfilled. This is the approach taken by Tim LaHaye when he and a man by the name of Jenkins wrote the Left Behind series, which has been very popular in our generation, that the book of Revelation deals primarily or almost exclusively with events at the end of the world. But the Lord said that it must begin to occur soon, shortly come to pass. The time is at hand. The futurist view leaves Revelation completely out of relationship to the needs of the churches to which it was originally addressed. And that's one of the problems with it. I believe the fulfillment starts with the very generation when John wrote and to which it was originally addressed. Obviously, it couldn't all happen at once. Now, the interesting thing about the futurist view is that a great many people around us in the religious world not only take the futurist view, but they're not even aware that there is any other view of the book of Revelation besides the futurist view. They just automatically see it through those spectacles when they look at it or think of it. There is another view that I'll mention to you and put on the board here, although it's not probably as predominant in our time. I'm just going to call it a spiritualist view. I don't mean that in terms of seances or anything, but I don't know what else to call this, and sometimes it's called that. I didn't want to just call it a spiritual view because that makes the others seem non-spiritual, and I don't want that to be true of the one that I'm taking. Anyway, the spiritualist view, as I'm speaking of it, is a sort of a philosophy of history that sees transcendent principles in history, sees recurrent themes running through history. And when it looks at the four horsemen in chapter 6, for example, it would see these four horses running through lots of different countries in lots of different eras of time. It would see the same things transpiring that are vaguely applicable in any age. If you've ever looked at William Hendrickson's commentary, More Than Conquerors, on the book of Revelation, then you know that he takes that particular view. So these are four possible approaches that numbers of people take, and I take the first one. If you happen to espouse one of these other views, we're very happy to have your comments during this class. We'd like to have your perspective shared in our study, and we can compare our understandings. I like to try to apply what the Apostle Paul said to the Thessalonians in 1 Thessalonians 5:21. Prove all things, hold fast that which is good. In a class like this, we can try to shake the chaff out from the wheat so far as correct understandings are concerned and take the wheat home with us and leave the chaff behind. But from my standpoint, we're looking at it from a historical point of view. Yes, Mike. Well, the Jesuits originated these two points of view, both the preterist, which would be a very early fulfillment before the full development of the great apostasy, and this would be a fulfillment later on in the future. And what they both do and what I believe they were both designed to do is take the pressure off the apostate church. This one hits in before, and this one comes in after. And I believe these two were developed because this one was making things pretty rough on the apostate church. That's why I think these were built. Now, I can't prove that's why they were built, but I can show that that's what they do, is take the pressure off the apostate church. Good question. Other questions I should have asked? Okay, well, so far you've managed to convince me that we're staying together as a class. If you go to church enough, though, you get good at faking that sometimes, so I can't tell for sure, but you look like you're with us. I think there are four general things necessary to understanding the book of Revelation. One is a general knowledge of the Bible. I've already sort of indicated that when I said maybe the book of Revelation should be studied after everything else in the Bible. It's not uncommon at all. In fact, it's very frequent to start studying the Bible with somebody in their home, and the first thing they want to study is the book of Revelation. That's really the last thing they probably need to study. But there's so much interest in this, and especially the speculative portions of this book, or speculative interpretations of it, that many want to study it first. We really need to get the whole Bible under our belt, ideally, before we study the book of Revelation in detail, I think. A second thing would be a knowledge of history. For most of the Bible, You can just take the Bible and the Bible alone and understand what the Lord is saying to us in His Word. But in some of these prophetic portions, we need to have a little bit of a knowledge of history to see how the fulfillment fits with the prophecies as they were made in the Bible. I do not believe that you can take the book of Revelation by itself and understand the intentions behind it, because it was not written in that kind of a way. I think we have to take the book of Revelation in one hand and a history book in the other hand and see the correspondence of these. A third thing that helps us to understand the book of Revelation is a special knowledge of the Old Testament prophets. Not only the whole Bible in general, which we need, but especially the Old Testament prophets, and especially the books of Ezekiel and Daniel. And I was very heartened yesterday when Tad told me that he had taught the book of Daniel here very recently, because that'll help us a lot. Really, to study the book of Revelation, we ought to go back to Daniel first. But I wasn't planning to do that anyway, because we wouldn't take the time for it. But I'm glad that we have that fastened to our minds now relatively recently. The book of Daniel gives so much. I mean, it's like the Old Testament apocalypse in a number of ways. So I'm glad that you have had that as a group together recently. I think that's very important. A fourth thing that I'll mention to you that I think is very significant in our understanding of the book of Revelation is just a knowledge of Bible symbols, how God has used symbols through His book from the first part of the Bible to the last part of the Bible. It's my contention that when you see, anything, like sun, moon, and stars, for example, when you see that used in the book of Genesis, and then you see it used in the book of Revelation, unless there's some reason to think otherwise, it means the same thing in the book of Genesis as it means in the book of Revelation. When Joseph had a dream about the sun, moon, and stars, the fulfillment of that is the same as sun, moon, and stars in, for instance, chapter 6 of the book of Revelation. It's talking about significant individuals. It was in Joseph's dream in Genesis 37, and it is in the book of Revelation, chapter 6 and following. We'll see a number of stars mentioned. We still use that word today, stars, to talk about prominent people. We've got a Hollywood Walk of Fame out in California where you walk down the sidewalk and there are stars every few feet. Some of you have walked along that way, undoubtedly. People that were of significant prominence to have their star put there. And they're referred to as stars still in our time. So it's not a stretch there at all that that symbol would mean the same thing all the way through the Bible. After all, God wants us to understand this. God is not changing His symbols just to confuse us. In baseball, professional baseball, where they've got cameras everywhere now, sometimes there will be a center field camera that's picking up everything that the catcher does there to, in the way of symbols. And if one team begins to think that the opposing team is picking up its symbols, they will change their symbol, their signals, in the middle of the game. But God's not changing His signals in the middle of the game. This is one thing I think that Jackie Robinson did when he first was in the major leagues, was to be very good at, when he'd get on second base, he'd be able to pick up these signals, and he's one of the ones that began to prompt other teams to change their signals a lot. God isn't doing that because He's not trying to confuse us. The question is often asked, can the book of Revelation be understood? Because it's such a favorite field of speculation for fanatical visionaries who may confuse many people. But yes, God wants us to understand this. All Scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable. What's the profit in this if we can't understand it? We're encouraged here in chapter 1, verse 4, to read it and to hear it and to keep the things that are written in it. This word revelation in verse 1 is the word apocalypsis. There's more than one way of spelling this, because we're just looking for the sound rather than what the actual English letters are that we use to create that sound. This word apocalypsis is confusing to a lot of people. They'll look in a Douay version or some other Roman Catholic Bible, and they'll see a book of apocalypse at the end, and no book of Revelation. But it's the same book. It's the same material. They've just transliterated that word into English letters, and we have translated the word into the word revelation. This word apocalypsis means to uncover, to lay bare, to make naked, to expose to view that which previously has been hidden. And if this is a revelation as it clearly says it is, then it is to be understood. It wouldn't reveal anything if we couldn't understand it. Martin Luther is supposed to have taken the book of Revelation and thrown a copy of it into the Elbe River because he was so frustrated that he couldn't understand it. But actually, I believe he lived a part of the fulfillment of it during his lifetime. This is not a sealed book. The seals are now loosed. The covering is rolled off so that the future, what was then future, can be seen. So we need to examine the symbols to determine the meaning of them by a comparison with history. Why was it written? Yeah, go ahead, Bob.
You said this is not a sealed book. Do we have a seal?
Well, Daniel, for instance, on one occasion was told to seal up the vision. It's not for your time. It's for the time much later on. So he was told to seal up the vision. Yes. Near the end of the book of Daniel. I don't know how extensively Ted got into that. We were talking a little yesterday about what portions he excluded from his study because of a lack of time, perhaps. So I don't know how extensively he went into that later portion of it. But there was a portion of the book of Daniel, at least, that was sealed, yes. And the book of Revelation used to be sealed. But now those seals have been opened by the Lamb of God, who prevailed to be qualified to do so. Good question. Other questions, comments? I appreciate you putting these questions in there, even though I keep forgetting to ask you if you've got them. Please continue to do that. That helps more than you know. It makes this class our class together. All right. We might ask ourselves just momentarily, what is the reason that this was written in symbols? If God wanted us to understand it so much, why didn't he just write it in a straightforward way? I think there are two or three reasons for that, at least. I believe it was written in symbols so that it might not be understood until each event was fulfilled. I do not believe the book of Revelation can contain new material that's essential for our salvation. The apostles' doctrine was complete prior to this time. Only one apostle ever saw the book of Revelation, and that's the one who wrote it. Even people in the 10th century, I don't believe, could see what we can see in the fulfillment of the book of Revelation. Martin Luther couldn't see what we can see when we look at the book of Revelation. We can look at the book and discern our own times, just as every generation theoretically should be able to do. But the things that would come after our own times might be a little more difficult. Dealing with unfulfilled prophecy is a very difficult thing. It always has been. But I also believe that the book of Revelation was written in symbols in order to conceal its meaning from all but the dedicated. You had to want to understand it in order to understand it. And Jesus said that his parables were written or given for the same reason. Remember, when Jesus spoke in parables, somebody asked him why. And he said, because there's a lot of people standing around listening to this, but it's not going to mean anything to certain ones of them. The persecutors of the Lord's people would not know the meaning of the parables. This was true of a lot of things that Jesus said. One time he said, If I be lifted up, will draw all men unto me. Well, who knew that that was going to be about being lifted up in crucifixion? It's only looking back that we understand all that he was saying there. It wasn't understood until it had happened. There's also an oriental beauty in the symbolism. Each symbol has its own specific significance, sort of like hieroglyphics. And we come to understand it in the way that we came to understand the Rosetta Stone. When the Rosetta Stone was first found, about 1799, by Napoleon's people down in Egypt, up by the Mediterranean, there were hieroglyphics on it, and there was common Egyptian, and there was Greek on it. And it was the same thing written in three ways. And that's the way we came to be able to determine what the meaning of hieroglyphics is. We had all these temples down in Egypt, and how could we tell what all those hieroglyphics meant? A man by the name of Champollion devoted his life to that for quite a while until he finally was able to decipher. And the book of Revelation is decipherable. I think it's important for us to believe that. The book of Revelation is history that was yet future when the book was written. The history of God's people and what they encountered from the time of writing until the end of time. It was all prophecy then, and much of it is history now. It was said in the book of Acts, chapter 15, verse 18, "Known unto God are all his works from the beginning of the world." The Apostle Paul in the Roman letter put it this way in chapter 4, that God sees the end from the beginning, and he calls those things which be not as though they were. But I want to caution you that the Lord in the book of Revelation is not just outlining all of history for us as if he was H.G. Wells ahead of his time, just writing an outline of history. That wasn't the purpose of it at all. Why would we need that? We can do that for ourselves. He wasn't writing the book of Revelation to just tell us about World War I or World War II or World War III. God was interested in what affected his people. And that's where he puts the emphasis. The book of Revelation naturally divides itself into four main sections. I'll place these up here. I'll just use the same numbers and put something different on there. Four main sections to the book of Revelation as I view it. Number one is chapter one, which is an introduction. Clayton read that for us, and we've been looking at it during these few moments of class. The second section is chapters 2 and 3, and those are the letters to the seven churches. And I understand that you've studied those here relatively recently, as well as a study of the Isle of Patmos, and I've been asked to just skip over those unless there's something that we especially need to go in about them. The third part of the book of Revelation, as I view it, begins in chapter 4 and roughly takes us through chapter 11. And then the fourth part would be roughly chapter 11 to the end, through chapter 22. And these were written, as we look at them, to answer two basic questions. Now, the Bible doesn't give us what the questions are, but sometimes we look at things in the Bible and we see what the answer is, and that helps us to know what the question was. Remember in the 1 Corinthian letter, Paul said, concerning the things that you wrote to me about, here are the answers. Well, we can figure out what the questions were by what the answers were. So I'm sort of extrapolating the questions out of the information that we have here. I believe this first section was written to answer the question, what's going to happen to the Roman Empire? The Old Testament, in the first place, in the second chapter of the book of Daniel, we have the backbone of biblical prophecy. You know, I've come to the place, I'm going to try to stay within my time here, especially the first part of the week, so you'll come back, Lord willing. I was told to push the buzzer at 20 after it. I'm sorry to stop at this particular place. Seems like I'm always in a bad place when it's time to stop. But we'll talk about that more later on, Lord willing. Right now, my job is to push this. I push just once?
Yeah. And you can go ahead a little until they all get back up here.
Okay. Well, all right. The Old Testament, in the backbone of biblical prophecy, that second chapter of the book of Daniel, it tells us about the four great world empires, and you all know what they were. The Old Testament covers three of those in a certain amount of detail. It talks about the Babylonian Empire. Nebuchadnezzar, thou art this head of gold. It talks about the Medo-Persian Empire. Just think of everything we have about that in the eighth chapter of the book of Daniel, for example. It talks and a lot about the Daniel under those people and Esther under those people. It talks about the Macedonian Empire. There's quite a bit in it about that. Chad was saying that he didn't really deal with the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, but this would come under that empire because the Roman Empire was not developed enough yet for us to be under that. That 11th chapter of the book of Daniel just sort of unfolds itself in one of the most amazing prophecies anywhere in the Bible. There's a lot in the Old Testament about Babylonian, the Medo-Persian, and the Macedonian Empire and the empires that came out of it. But there is relatively little in the Old Testament about the Roman Empire. We've got some things in Daniel 7 and so forth, I believe. But basically, it's left to the New Testament book of prophecy, the book of Revelation, to tell us about the unfolding of the Roman Empire and how that affected the people of God. So that's what I think this third section is about. Since I'm still talking, I guess I'll write as well. I think that then when we come to this, maybe this is the backside of the scroll, I'm not sure, but we're looking at the same period of time here, but we're looking at it from a different point of view. What's going to happen to the church? So those are the four main sections as I see them. And Lord willing, we'll be looking at those in a systematic way. Thank you very much for your kind attention.